Hey guys, welcome back to the Moms Talk Autism podcast. Today we are continuing on with part two in our Jonathan Alderson series. So sit back and we will be right back with you.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream, a better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
So, Jonathan, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again. We absolutely enjoyed you and what you had to say thoroughly. It was a very enriching conversation, very robust in the topics at hand that we covered and where we left off, you know, and talking about setting goals and by how attitude drives behavior. And then we started to get curious about a conversation around behavior in general and what comes up a lot in our community. And everyone has, even within our own group here, within the podcast, right? But because it comes down to like different, you know, everyone has different parenting approaches. You know, sometimes they're authoritarian or dictator or attachment parenting or there's all different parenting styles again that also drive the operating systems in terms of like of goal setting, outlook, approach, so on and so forth. And so we get asked like, well, how do you discipline your kids, quote unquote, or just the ambiguity.
You got it.
Of discipline.
Yes. Good job.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. I can do hard things, me and my vocabulary. So it's such a nuanced conversation and everyone has a different filter for what that means. And especially in this realm. And once you get into this realm and if you do any type of behavioral therapies with your child, which I would say majority of us have in some form or another, and even if you didn't necessarily adopt one form as a parent, there are within the systems your kids are, there's antiquated behavioral practices within those too. So behavior in general is just a very nuanced conversation, and it's a conversation that I don't say that we dance around it. We don't dance around it. It's just so complex and so different. Again, and because our kids are so different too, and we are different as parents, like we said, everybody just responds and executes quote unquote discipline differently and like what defines discipline. So please tell us your thoughts and feelings and approaches on that.
That's a lot of stuff. And first of all, thank you for having me back. It's nice to see you guys. The Moms Talk Autism crew. And I agree, our conversation last time, I was enriched by it as well. I've said this before, I really have learned most of what I know from moms, from parents, from dads, speaking and listening to lived experience and all the range of both, I mean, we're talking about emotions, behavior, all of life. And so thank you for sharing also your stories and your ideas, because I learn too. I heard a couple of words in there that I think are charged words that we could dive into a little bit. You use the word discipline.
Yeah.
Right. And I would even say parenting word. Approach is a charged word, because, you know, people have strong opinions on how we should approach parenting, and fair enough, it's your kids. And what I try and do is not to tell a parent you should do it this way, or you should take this approach, because we all, I think there is diversity in parenting, and you know, what do I know about what's going to be best for your family values and your family background and where you want to head to? What I try and do is I try and help parents to be their best of self, to help the parents be their best of parents. So if you want to be a real disciplinarian, I want to help you do that in the most effective, best loving way possible for your child, as an example, if that makes sense. And so having worked with around 3,000 families in many, many countries around the world in all sorts of different situations, I've been able to work with a whole range of different parenting approaches and different belief systems around how you should raise kids. And here's one thing that's common around the world. Doesn't matter what the age of the child is, doesn't matter what the age of the parent is, doesn't matter what approach, what language, what faith. What's common universally is that 100% of parents I've ever worked with absolutely, totally agree and intend and want to love their kids. I'm saying this for a reason. I'm not trying to sound sentimental. This is a really, really important thing, is they want their children to feel loved, and they want to be a loving parent, of course. And yet, one of the reasons I'm often in a living room or on a phone call is because the parents are really struggling with, you know, they're losing it. They're losing their cool, or they're getting angry, and it goes beyond discipline at times. And it's not a fun ride, and they're feeling worn out, and they're feeling like they're being the police parent all day long. Why doesn't my kid listen to me? And I'm pissed off. And, you know, sort of life happens. And so I'm pulled into the conversation to sort of figure out how we could get back to that joy of parenting, even with a very challenging child or challenging behavior, challenging autism, and so on and so forth. So I just want to say that as a prelude is I typically stay out of big conversations about what's the right way to parent, and more how can we enhance your best of self parenting. So this is a prelude. But let me just dive in here for 1 second. I think probably the biggest trap that we fall into as humans with each other, and this absolutely falls in the category of parenting with kids, but also with marriages and coworkers, is we're raised and our society set up often such that how we feel is based on how other people behave. So if my child is sitting nicely in the back seat of the car and not kicking my chair as I'm driving, then I'm a happy mom or dad. And if my child is doing other behaviors that I don't want, then I'm an unhappy mom. In other words, my feelings of goodness and happiness and how I'm feeling is directly related to how my kid's behaving. And that might extend to all sorts of other things in your life. And most people would say, yes, I mean, not only what's wrong with that, but isn't that normal? I mean, if I'm getting what I want, I'm happy. If I'm not getting what I, you know, what I want, then I'm unhappy. The problem with that is, guys, and we all know this, the big reveal here, right? The dirty laundry is we often don't get what we want. And especially with children with special needs and with differences and different ways of thinking and autistic children who see things, feel things, hear things, think things differently. We're not always aligned together with our children in terms of how we should get, you know, ready for bed. That looks different in the mind of an autistic child than a mom's brain, potentially. And so what I'm saying is the probability for unhappiness is very high if I attach my happiness to outcomes in that way. Does that make sense to you guys? If I set myself up psychologically as saying, if my child falls along this line of behavior, I'm feeling good, I'm feeling comfortable, I'm feeling happy. When they step out of line, then I'm not happy. And that's problematic, because here's a guarantee: your child won't behave properly. So it's sort of like you're guaranteed to not be happy. Okay. So what's an alternative? Well, that's how we're set up.
I don't know. It's kind of making me feel like I need to go have a margarita for the rest of this conversation.
No, I think I love about what you said is, I think that we have to take a little bit of responsibility and accountability for our own attitudes and our own reactions,
yeah,
right? 100%. We can't I try to teach this to my now 18-year-old is you can't control how people are going to treat you throughout the day, but you can decide
how you react,
how the rest of your day goes,
how you react,
right? And how you handle it. So I like that because I do think our lives are difficult. And I do think there is a lot in our lives that we maybe can't control, but maybe if we take a little bit of that power back and decide that we do have a little bit of responsibility for the way that we see things and respond.
Shannon, 100%. I'm going to push it a little bit further. If you don't mind, you said maybe we have a little bit of responsibility for how we feel. I would suggest that you have 100% responsibility for how you feel.
No, I love that.
And how you and I love that you're teaching your daughter that.
Permission to push you.
that you're what a gift for you for your daughter. That you're it's your daughter. You said yes. Yeah,
my oldest. Yeah,
that she's learning that at a younger age, right? Than seeing her, sort of kind of psychotherapist in her mid 40s. Like it's terrific that she can do this now and kind of learn that and take responsibility to some degree, more or less, whatever. But she'll be in situations where she hears your voice and remembers, oh, I can choose how I want to respond to this. I can't control necessarily that the bus is late. It's a public bus. I can't control that. I'm sitting here at the bus stop. I can't make the bus come faster. I can choose how I want to spend the next 5 minutes waiting for it, though. Either angry and frustrated and mad, or maybe saying, hey, good. I just gained myself 5 more minutes to do gratitude. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to think of how many things I'm grateful for the next 5 minutes till the bus comes. That might sound a bit Hallmarkish, but you know, Hallmark card kind of thing, but this is the kind of strategy we can teach, by the way. And by the way, I have taught with my team's autistic students this idea. When you don't get the toy that you want, instead of tantruming, there's other options. I mean, there's the option of go find another toy to play with, but also there's other ways that you can feel also. So that's kind of neat. So moving on, so I'm just throwing that out. That's interesting. And why that's important, by the way, is three things. This is three benefits, what we just talked about. As a parent, I'm the adult in the room. I'm parenting a child who doesn't have so much self-regulation about their emotions. And neurologically, they don't. They haven't been on the planet long enough, but we're adults. We can, you know, do some cognitive behavioral thinking. We can think, oh, why is that pissing me off? Why do I have to change? Whatever. And so we can do some of that adjustment for ourselves and take that ownership that you're talking about, Shannon. But here's the three benefits for it. One is there's a high probability, as we said, that I don't always get what I want from my child. So at least I can start to give myself some peace, some respite, a bit more de-stress. Because I'm choosing to feel differently about the situation. So that's just number one. I can just feel a little bit better. And even if it works only half of the time, then 50% of the time I'm choosing better. If it happens, works only 30%, great. 30% of the time you're choosing calm over stress. Just to choose, literally to choose. There's Cheerios all over the floor. They're being ground now into the carpet and the tiles as my kid walks through the living room. And, you know, serenity now, serenity now. So that's one benefit. Here's the second benefit. I'm modeling to my child how to stay more calm when you don't get what you want, which is a huge thing that lots of parents call me about to say, how do I help my kid not panic and freak out when he is at the back of the line, not the front of the line at Disneyland or whatever that is, right? That tantrum, that upset. Mm-hmm. It's okay. We're going to be okay. I model that throughout my day. I say, oh, there's Cheerios all over the floor, guys. We got to clean them up. Let's have a Cheerio cleaning party. You're on broom. I'm on dustpan. And what song do you want to put on while we're doing this? You guys want to go with Britney Spears or Michael Jackson? And they're going to go Britney Spears and Michael Jackson. Who is that? How old are you, Dad? So, but modeling that I don't have to freak out with chairs on the floor, but we're totally going to clean them up, by the way, and there may even be a consequence. But my attitude is modeling to my child. So that's number two. It's brilliant. And number three is this, and this is what we talked about at the end of the call, which is my attitude impacts my behavior. And it turns out that when I'm a little bit more patient, or I'm a little bit more loving, or I'm a little bit more calm, or I'm a little bit more playful, it turns out that my child or my students pay more attention. I have better rapport and they're more compliant. So I end up getting more of what I want. Mm-hmm. That's where we started, right? How do you, we talked about discipline and compliance. And one of the key strategies that we teach in the multi-treatment approach is, if you're a more attractive person as an adult, a parent, a mom, a dad, a teacher, kids are paying attention. They're going to comply more. They're going to go along with you. And so by me choosing to adopt a certain attitude as a strategy of rapport, I get better compliance.
I like that. I want to do a little bookmark in a note because we may get into this later. I know we're going to get some pushback from some parents of, you know, kiddos who are non-speaking. So they feel like maybe they have a lack of, you know, being able to communicate those things. But then I know that we do have also a section of our community, two of us at least here on the podcast also, that have kids who get aggressive when they're not getting their way. So I just want to put a pin, because you may be heading in that direction at some point, that I would love to talk about consequences when it does come to aggressive behaviors, especially when our kids get to the point where they are as strong or stronger than we are.
Yeah, it's a major problem. I mean, even like, again, for educators and having kids, you know, older kids in classrooms and kids that can have behaviors and how to de-escalate, but not even just de-escalate, but get in front of that, the antecedent before it even happens. Mm-hmm. And it starts with that type of mindset. An approach, adopting that approach, adopting that rapport, if you will.
100%. Yeah, that's a great point. By the way, so, and thank you, Shannon, just for bringing up the range of your listeners, parents out there, verbal, nonverbal children, aggressive children, non-aggressive children. There's always a range. And that's why it's so, so difficult to make statements that apply to everybody. And it's certainly not what I do. I haven't written a book that says this is how to parent kids with autism, because you can't do it. You can do principles, but you can't do it.
Spoiler alert.
And we all understand
you
that.
Know that. You know that. Yes. And you know that, yeah. Because you have 75 books on autism on your shelf and you're still looking for the answer. So, yeah. I was just going to add, and again, thank you for just putting a pin in that, but I was going to add, for all of the parents listening right now, who have very young children, let's say sort of the 2.5-year-olds, 3, 3.5, 4, let's say 5 and under, and you're in that space where this is true. You're in that developmental phase where your child hasn't yet taken unhappiness totally seriously yet. It's still something they use, that, and they can often know it. Even an autistic child I'm talking about, right? And what I mean by that is, as a child, we learn that unhappiness and crying and whining and tantruming is a way to move people. And by the time we're usually about 14, 15, 16 into our teens and adulthood, we forget that we're in control of it. Meaning, I'm legitimately really mad. Whereas a child can kind of turn it on and turn it off, right, in some way. And why I'm saying that is, when I work with a family with a younger child, I work really intensely with them, with the parents, to do, Shannon, what you're saying that you're doing with your older daughter, but with a younger child, which is to teach them how to respond to things when they don't get what they want, and still to go with what they want, to still ask for things that they want, but to do it in a kind way, in a gentle way, in a non-pushing way, and to not get upset if you don't get what you want. So I'm just saying to all the parents listening that that is a possibility. And we don't have time today to go so deeply, deeply into how do I do that exactly? We've talked about it a little bit. Partly it's how you respond to your life. And that's a model to your children. It's a framework, right? The bus isn't here. Should I be angry and frustrated or not? Getting angry or frustrated doesn't make the bus come faster, by the way. And having a tantrum doesn't make me let you stay up until midnight watching Star Wars, because you're like, you're 3.5 years old. You got to go to bed. But if I can teach my child how to respond differently, then it makes the teen years much better. That's all I'm saying. So for those of you in that younger spot, you have a chance to re-engineer something that parents who have older kids can still do, but it definitely gets a bit harder as they're older.
So in that same vein, and it's not necessarily just the more tangible, noticeable things, but there's also kids, there may not necessarily, again, there's also the discrepancy or delineation between what is a tantrum and what is a meltdown. Mm-hmm. And I know that in old school ABA does not want to identify anything as quote unquote a meltdown. Everything is qualified as a tantrum. But kids specifically, I mean, I know my son, but many of our kids, and as a matter, again, even though his subtype is more profound, even kids that are higher functioning, they have high levels of perseveration and their attachment to, once they've decided something, they can't cognitively detach from that. And so I'm trying to figure out how to couch that, how it doesn't necessarily always equate into like, I'm going to have a tantrum or I'm going to be aggressive, but it is to them, they're completely distressed at this point. So it also just can be total, like they are crying, they are sobbing, you know, they are, for them, it's not just the payoff of not, it's not just the my way thing. It's almost like something deeper than that. And a lot of our kids have that perseveration that goes along with being very rigid. So how do you, I guess, I don't know, it'd be better to ask an example of goal setting around that. What does that look like?
Yeah. Great question. Especially when we're talking about autistic kids, autistic population, because as we know, one of the diagnostic criteria is repetitious ritualized behaviors. And you know, you can use the word perseveration or stims, isms, all of that stuff. And you know, as parents, that there's a pretty wide range of how to approach stims, isms, repetitious behaviors. If I can, and by the way, wrote a chapter on ritualized repetitious behaviors, mm-hmm. in my book, Challenging the Myths of Autism. And I dive into kind of the latest research and different models and different views and to present parents with something more than just the ABA standard, which is those are inappropriate, non-functional, distracting behaviors, and you got to stop them. And that, if that's the approach that you take, then you get a lot of resistance from the child. Typically, a lot of kids push back against that. And so the stim or the ism or the repetitious behavior becomes a battleground with a lot of parents and their child on some level. But here's an idea, Jean, just to address, to step back for a second. I'm going to share with you a technique and a strategy that we use that is a game changer. I'm going to open the vault and let you write in.
That is a big declaration right there, Jonathan.
Well so there's two. If you said, Jonathan, of everything you've done with all the kids you've worked with, all the success you've had and everything that you've learned, what's like the number one or number two thing? I'll tell you. And I'm going to tell you number two. We talked about number one is attitude. I've had the most positive effect on lives of families and kids and seen them, you know, change their lives by really focusing on attitude. Here's number two. Number two thing that is a radical change is what we call receptivity. And receptivity is just a way of talking about rapport. And here's what we do is we time our requests and demands and communications when a child or an adult or a teenager or whoever is receptive. And when they're not receptive, we don't do demands and commands and try and teach. That's the key. That's it. I'm going to explain it to you right now, but that's it. And it looks like this. Okay. I'm going to give you an analogy, real life analogy. If you go to Starbucks, if you go to Dunkin' Donuts, if you go to McDonald's, if you go to whatever your brand of place that you go and you place an order over a counter, and I'm talking to all the adults listening right now. All of you, I'm sure, are always aware of whether the barista or whoever's on the other side of the counter is receptive to you. When you walk in, right? If you go in to the counter, and I know some Starbucks I go into might be some younger people on the other side of the counter, and they're chit-chatting to each other, or they're laughing, or they're serving, they're warming up a bun or whatever they're doing, and they're not ready to take your order. And when you walk into the store and you see they're not ready to take an order, you don't place an order to the thin air, right? You don't start talking to nobody. You have to wait until they turn and they're receptive to you. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Now, you might have to get their attention, or you wait until they come over. And have you ever had a person come over to the counter and they say, "Hi, how can I help you?" And you go to place your order, "I'll have a coffee, I'll have a donut." But as you're doing that, they turn and say something to someone else, like mid-sentence. And then they go back and say, "Oh, sorry, what was that?" That's they weren't receptive for a minute. And then they were receptive. And then you can place your order. And you're really good at being able to see if the person is attentive and receptive. And we know that because they give us eye contact. They're facing us. They're not doing other things. They're not playing Candy Crush. They're not talking to somebody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you guys are measuring receptivity. So that's perfect. You guys get that. Here's the interesting thing is when it comes to our children and our husbands or our wives, we often totally ignore whether they're receptive or not, and we place orders all the time. And so our kids are totally in a video, or they're running around the room, or they're in a stim or an ism or repetitious behavior or whatever, and we give them an important command, like it's time to get ready for bed, or please come to the dinner table, or have you done your homework? And we talk to our spouse from one room to the other when they are doing something else, not receptive. And then we get mad when they, quote, didn't listen. Didn't you hear what I said? The answer is no. I was totally absorbed in something else. And so the strategy is very, very simple, guys. Apply the same level of rigor of waiting until someone is receptive to place an order at a Dunkin' Donuts as you do Dunkin' Donuts at home. So in a therapeutic setting with my therapist, with my team, when we're in a, what we call a fun room, our classroom, our workroom, one of the very first things we train on, guys, is how do you identify when an autistic child is receptive? A particular individual child, they're all different. Everyone's different. We're all unique, right? How do I know when Shannon is receptive to me? If she's looking at me, but her lips are kind of pursed and her eyes are really wide and she's giving me this look, I don't know if she's 100% receptive to what I'm about to say. She's attentive. She's going to listen, but I bet you she's having some thoughts. Maybe she's already pre-decided this is a no. And so I might need to chat a little bit before I make a request. You guys with me? Mm-hmm. And so if I'm working with a 7-year-old autistic child who has a lot of repetitious ritualized behaviors, and he is involved in one, it's not a great time, I don't think, to make an important demand or request or to communicate something important. On a biological level, we know that if your brain is partly engaged in something else, like a rocking motion or a tapping motion or a visual stim or whatever it is, we know that the brain is not receptive entirely to commands and demands and communication, that kind of stuff. So you're going to say, so what do you do then? And we can get to that. But the key here, the game changer I'm telling you, is if you do one thing after this podcast, do one thing, and you start to pay attention to the receptivity level of your autistic child, and you start to strategically time demands, commands, requests, communication, when they're more receptive, and don't do a lot of talking and demands when they're not receptive, your success rate of compliance and listening and follow through from your child will go up, I'm not making this up, easily 50%, which is huge. That's a game changer right there. If I could get 50%. Now, you're not going to make as many commands and demands all the time because they're not so receptive a lot of the time. By definition, autism, they're doing their own thing. They're in their own, you know, they're focused on a lot of internal stuff, sensory issues, lots of stuff. And so if you are doing ABA data collection on one of our IMTI sessions, here's what you would see. The demand load in terms of the frequency of demands are really quite low, but the follow through and success on the child, very high, like 90% or higher success. So a family will watch me in a half an hour session with one of their kids, because I go in, I still work with kids and I model, and they'll say, my son did almost everything you asked. The heck is going on? How do you do that? What's going on? And I'll say, well, I mean, there's a lot of things going on, but one is, did you notice I only asked for four things in the last half hour? And I timed each of those requests when your child was receptive, focused, looking, available. And so he did them for the most part.
So one of the things that I was trained at, parent trained in, is the term and approach called creating behavior momentum. And behavior momentum is basically that, is creating the space for that receptivity. Mm-hmm. And when that behavior momentum is not successful, that's an indicator too that that's not the time to place a demand. You don't even have, there's no way to place a demand at that point. But that's one of the things. And just to give an example of what behavioral momentum looks like, just even in like a typical classroom setting, or even if you've been to a conference and you have either the teacher or the leader of the room going, clap your hands twice if you can hear me. It's calling attention, making sure that everyone has shut down whatever their distraction is or whatever else they're focused on. And it's now that they're engaged in whatever it is you're asking them to be engaged in. And if that's how sometimes you can see how teachers can be magical like that, because they won't proceed until they have gauged the temperature in the room with their students that they are all ready to be receptive and listening. And I don't know, again, it obviously, it's also getting kids to be even receptive to that level of that command. That may not be the behavioral momentum that you're giving to your autistic child. I think with Rory, it started out, again, based on what he was receptive to. I watched the behavioral technicians and the BCBAs being like, touch your nose, touch your head, you know, or jump up and down. And it would just kind of interrupt the brainwave enough. Sometimes if it wasn't even necessarily to place a demand, it was maybe sometimes to interrupt that perseveration, mm-hmm. you know, and giving, trying to create. I now, where I'm trying to do is to get you to be calm. So I found them using that approach to either, again, get ready to be prepared to place a demand, or it was to get him to de-escalate in some way. And it was hard thing for me to tell staff, you know, or like other part of the members of the team, if they weren't behavior technicians or they weren't trained in this, they didn't really understand what I was talking about or how I was applying. And I really struggled with, you know, my now ex-husband, I struggled with him, with their dad, getting him to understand that. And when we're talking about bandwidth and rapport, I want to say bandwidth, I'm going to add another term on here, but there is bandwidth here. I remember, you know, I had clearly, and I still do, I have more of the bandwidth for helping my son navigate these things, when whether he is about to tantrum or meltdown, or he's perseverating or engaging in behavior, or I'm trying to quote unquote, for just sake of using charge terminology, get compliance or whatever it is. I was modeling that. I can go back and reflect and saying my attitude was better when I at least had another parent to at least, or another body or human body to kind of like occupy. And it could be in this case to be operate the vehicle. Okay, you're driving. I just need you to focus on driving. I will focus all of my energy here. But when my bandwidth now is, I'm also operating the vehicle and I have to de-escalate you, I'm noticing, you know, my mood, my behavior, all of those things, my attitude is all down because my capacity, my bandwidth is down. And so I guess, again, it's being self-reflective to enough and introspective enough to recognize, like, if you aren't within your bandwidth or agency, you can't exactly implement those demands. But sometimes those demands are still required. I don't know. It's so hard. Does that make sense? Like, especially when you're confronted with an issue where there's a safety concern, right? Like you're in a parking lot, right? And so you're mitigating several environmental factors there, like wait, your eyes as the parent, and you also are, it's such a nuanced thing, kind of, you know, thrown into the fire, kind of immediate, like maybe not even anticipated. Sometimes some of us can, our kids' behaviors can be so predictable, but you'll also hear parents talk about situations like, I wasn't even expecting that. That came out of nowhere, kind of thing. How, based on that feedback here, and then I also want us to move into other parts of our discussion, how do you coach parents through that or evaluate those kind of circumstances?
All right. Jean, you, thank you again for, you know, really bringing real life, if you will, to the conversation. I know that's what your crew does, okay. Right? Like, hey, we're moms living real lives. Like, let's talk about that. And so for total disclosure, and I think it's important, and you're making this line to say there's working in a therapy room, working in what we call a fun room setting, and then there's in a parking lot, go to Walmart, right? And
exactly.
But I want to say they're both important, right? They're both important, but they're different conversations too. So, you rolled out a lot there, but what I would say is there's a relationship. But it's good because there's a relationship between building rapport and learning to do a puzzle, and I'm picking something very mundane, or build a Lego tower with your child, 14 years old, 7 years old, 3 years old. There's a relationship between being able to do that in a more closed environment, i.e. not a parking lot, and getting along and learning how to share pieces and take turns and have some eye contact and learn about receptivity and when should I push forward and when shouldn't I? And then being in a Walmart parking lot and being able to leverage that rapport. There's a relationship. And one of the things that doesn't happen in our field, the field of autism training, one of the things that doesn't happen enough is empowering parents to have great relationships with their kids.
Mm.
Okay, now that's pretty spicy for me to say in a lot of ways. So even for parents who are listening, I got a great, I love my kid. He loves me. We're not talking about how much you love your child. You guys are deeply committed. You're devoted. You run your lives around your kids. There's no doubt about it. But let me just unpack that just for a sec, okay? So, Jean, most, not all, by the way, I'm making big generalizations, but most parents spend most of their time parenting rather than doing therapy or rather than building rapport for half an hour. And so parenting necessarily involves get your shoes on, take your shoes off, get ready for bed, brush your teeth, sit at the table, don't run across a parking lot. And you are playing police. We talked about this before. And so the primary style of relationship you have with your child is you're supervising them to get through their day. Primarily, mostly, largely. You might have some time on Saturdays to go to a ball game. And so that's maybe something a little bit different. But even at the ball game, you got to supervise them. And why I'm saying that is what we do in our program on purpose is we say, let's try and carve out of your extremely busy day and full life half an hour a day or half an hour every 2 days or 1 hour every 3 days where you're going to do what we would call a rapport building session. A la kind of floor time, a la sunrise, a la play base kind of thing. And in other words, you're not trying to teach them to draw a circle or teach them to print their name or teach them to do mathematics. It's rapport building. It's like going on a date with your husband. It's like that. It's the same concept. It's saying, hey, we've been married for 20 years. When was the last time we went on a date? Do you remember when we did that? And since then, we've been working, having careers, taking care of your in-laws, making money for a mortgage and parenting. And we kind of forgot about our relationship. And guess what? That takes a toll, not just on the relationship, but our ability to communicate, collaborate, enjoy each other and all that kind of stuff. So then when I look at you in that marriage, in that relationship, and I say, hey, could you pass me a fork? Instead of saying, of course, sweetheart, because we have great rapport, you're like, kind of get it yourself, or why are you always demanding me? And we blow up because I asked you for a fork. And we don't have that rapport that we used to have. And I am saying the same thing, which is even though you gave birth to your child, incredible, phenomenal thing you did. And even though you're completely committed to your child and you assume that they should pay attention to you and you assume that they should do what you ask them to do, but you don't have that rapport, even though you're a deeply committed parent and you love them and you bought them the moon and back and all the toys you could possibly get them and you give them everything, but you're not necessarily building rapport in the way that humans have to build rapport, which is I got to go on a date with you. I got to spend some time. I got to play Lego with you for 20 hours, 20 minutes a day. That's what we're saying.
I love this.
And when you invest in that, and it sounds like there's a lot of parents listening saying, Jonathan, I don't have 20 minutes. What are you talking about? I have three other kids and, you know, a career. I get it. But the investment in rapport, which is receptivity, is like, it's incredible. And then when you're in the parking lot and you have to say, take my hand, sweetheart, and don't run. Their receptivity, you built rapport. There's a different relationship there and you get a lot more back. So that's how I would respond to what you said.
Again,
I want to like jump in there too, you know, because we talked at the end of the last episode, we were talking about intentionality and being intentional with our attitude and the things that we're doing. And I think like a lot of parents who listen to this podcast, you know, we feel like we have 1,000 things to do every day. We're constantly running around, you know, like chickens with our heads cut off. And I tend to be one of those people. I'm extremely busy. And so I can get very caught up in things that I'm doing. But what I'm hearing you say and what I appreciate so much is there is a difference between parenting and showing up and engaging with our children.
Relationship building. Sorry to interrupt, but I'd say in relationship building, there's getting through the day and totally being attentive to that and totally being organized and totally going to the IEP meeting and totally making sure your child has the right running shoes. You're right. But relationship building is different.
Exactly. And I, you know, I had made a goal this year that intentionality in many things was going to be my biggest focus. And I've tried very much in the last month, we're in February now, to, you know, if Gracie comes over and she wants to engage with me and I have my laptop out because I'm working, I'm being very intentional to close it and move it to the side and engage. And the other night, and there's a reason I'm going here, but the other night I had 1,000 things to do, but Gracie took my hand and she pulled me into her bedroom and we have a sensory swing hanging in her bedroom. And she just wanted, she will swing on her own for 2 hours a day. She has no problem, but she wanted me to swing her in her bedroom. And it was difficult because I am a type one control freak human and I like to get things done. But I took 20 minutes until bedtime and I just swung with her.
Beautiful.
Part of the time she wanted me to attend and engage with her. And other times she just wanted me to watch. That's what she wanted. But the reason I bring that up is this has only been my focus, you know, since January 1st. But I am already noticing a difference in buy-in with Gracie. And her, it didn't take a year, I guess, is what I want to get across. So to the parents who are out there and they're like, oh my God, like, okay, yeah, I can give you 10 minutes a day, but I don't have 2 years to wait for this, right? It doesn't take a significant period of time, or at least it hasn't in this case.
And Shannon, I don't know your daughter. I don't know the situation and the challenges and the strengths and that, but can I guess that there are times that part of your programming for part of your wants, part of your dream is for her to be more social, to have different relationships, to interact, maybe initiate with her peers and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And here she is initiating. Here she is saying, you know, come and stand in the bedroom with me while I swing, or give me a little push, or just be here. And I'm saying that because that's what we work towards and want. And so when it's happening, absolutely respond. So that's beautiful. By the way, I remember working with a family who had come from England. They had about a 3.5, 4-year-old little girl who didn't interact. And one of the sadnesses that the father in particular had shared is that his daughter didn't interact with him at all. She was really fairly in her own space. And so our team worked very intensely with her. And on the fourth day of working with this little girl and the family, it was my turn to do some parent coaching. And I came in early morning, about 8:30, 9 a.m. And the father was a little bit upset. And he pulled me aside. He said, Jonathan, can I talk with you for a second? Sure. And he said, listen, you know, we see what your staff are doing. We're seeing some good stuff, but I'm quite concerned where this might go, because this morning I got up and I always read my newspaper in the morning. I was reading my newspaper in the morning and my little girl was, you know, bugging me. Came over and was tugging at the newspaper. And then she kind of climbed on up on the sofa and kind of got in my lap and I had to put her down. I was telling her, you know, hey, listen, I got it. And his whole thing was, you know, we don't want a little girl that's going to not know boundaries and it's going to be interruptive. And we're really quite concerned of what you're teaching her. And I paused and very gently said, hey.
Also, eyes wide open that no one else can see.
Listen, but I said, and not in a cheeky fashion either, just really, and I hope just with a lot of love for this guy who's learning his parenting, his journey, three or four-year-old little girl. And I said, congratulations, but not in a sarcastic way. And I didn't stop. They said, congratulations, you have just won the lottery. You have a little girl who 4 days ago, I remember with sadness, you said, and honest, like you're just, you know, lamenting that you didn't have a connection with your daughter. And last night, from what you described, or sorry, this morning after breakfast, you described a little girl who's seeking out your attention. She's seeking out wanting to be physically close with you and interrupt your reading. Now, she doesn't know how to do it in the right way yet. She's 4 years old. It's autism, and we can maybe teach her how to say, you know, use some words and all that kind of stuff. But isn't this beautiful? So I'm saying that just why I'm bringing that up is rapport building, wanting to spend time, taking those moments, putting your newspaper down. Shannon, you know, it's a story similar to yours in some way, right? Like pay attention to that, respond to that. What I'm adding on is, so in that case, your daughter came to you. In that example I gave, that little girl came to her father. But what about also carving out intentional time to say, you know, I don't know what it is, 20 minutes before bedtime, 20 minutes before we go to school after we've had breakfast on a Saturday, whenever it is, when we do playtime, what we call rapport time, rapport building time, like again, a date. And I intentionally don't have my laptop with me. I don't have my newspaper and I'm just there. And that's what I do. Now, I want to say one thing, and this relates to Jean, what you brought up about repetitious behaviors and your son and, you know, touch your nose, touch your, this kind of stuff and redirection, interruption. So for everyone listening, you might have a thought, yeah, but what if when I want to play with my child, he's not ready, or he's just stimming, or he's involved in something, or he's on the computer jamming out with, you know, Fortnite or whatever it is. Here's what we do. I'll just tell you what our answer is play Fortnite for half an hour. What if he doesn't want to let me? Sit and watch. What if he's rocking back and forth at that time when I have 20 minutes that I put? Sit with him and rock back and forth. You don't have to play Lego.
Join in.
Do it for 20 minutes. If your 20 minutes is up and he's so rocking, you look to him and say, thank you. That was beautiful. I love sharing that with you. I got to go make dinner. And so the point is this. If you go on a date with your husband or wife or somewhere, it usually doesn't really matter that much if you go and see a movie or you go out Chinese food or you go for a walk. It matters that we did something together. Am I right? I mean, it doesn't really matter that much. It's like, sweetheart, it doesn't really matter to me whether you go to Italian or Chinese. I just want to have a meal with you and have some time to chat and be with you. The food type doesn't matter.
Well, and I love.
And it's sort of like that. It doesn't really matter if we do a certain kind of thing, but I'm going to spend 20 minutes just being with you.
Well, and I think the fact that you're calling it, like, I love that you're calling it a date, right? Because by implying it's a date, you're sort of taking out the, I have to be teaching. I have to be, you know, like, yeah, exactly.
Go
on a date with our spouses to have fun. Like, let's go on a date with our kids to do what they want to do and have fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Have rapport building.
It's hard. So, sometimes.
Jean, you had, sorry, there's a word that you had said earlier. You said behavior momentum, and you were finding that analogy. And I love that. And I would very intentionally shift the language, and I would say rapport momentum or relationship momentum. And because we tend to behaviorize our autistic kids.
Oh, yes.
As opposed to humanize them. And you weren't doing that. I'm just saying that behavior momentum, it's sort of sucking the relationship out of humanness. Like, I don't have behavior momentum with my spouse. I have a relationship, right? Like, we are holding hands. We are walking. We said hello. Like, no, I'm in love. I'm having a relationship. And the same with my kid. I love my kid. We have fun. We have a relationship. And sometimes I'm angry and sometimes he doesn't like me. So it's sort of, I think behavior to me is so clinical and sterile. And so we use the word rapport. I talked about receptivity. I'm talking about emotions as well as behavior, like eye contact. So I just wanted just to say that. I think that's something.
It's, and I'll tell you what it does. You are right. It does suck the life out of it. It doesn't make it alive, right? It just makes it this.
I know it's hard. It's intense.
Right. And I'm also, you're saying this from, you know, you're a researcher. So even like by definition, again, you're talking about like a scientific approach to things, right? But we've talked about it on other episodes when we had a therapist on. And one of our coping mechanisms for some of us in this group, as well as herself, when she was speaking, was that she intellectualizes that.
Right.
And part of what helped me, or does tend to help me when I'm like struggling and I've dug in and I'm doing all this research and my output is that I intellectualize these things. Like, okay, well, now I have a comprehension and understanding, as if that is somehow giving me some form of self-regulation at the moment. And it's also not allowing my having to talk about my feelings or process my feelings around it or my relationship to it. I'm just talking about
the behavior, right?
And like, so you become very enveloped in that way of thinking and doing, and that's so pervasive. And this was a perfect example of how pervasive that actually is and how far that can take it. And that actually then can drive your attitude into your child's behavior. Like, it all brings it all around full circle.
Mm-hmm. I hope that was okay that I said that. I just wanted to.
Absolutely.
Okay. Right. All right.
Absolutely. Totally say that. And the funny thing, everybody needs to be calling me out on my stuff. Someone needs to behaviorize me, please.
I'm just saying it's not that romantic to say to your next boyfriend, hey, I think we've got a lot of good behavior momentum right now with this relationship.
It's not sexy at all. You're exactly right. No, it is not. It is not. we'll be sure to use that. So this actually is a good segue. Work with families and have clearly worked with them one-on-one and like the whole spectrum of their treatment plans, we'll say, you know, where you're creating synergy in between all the different approaches and all the different environments, you know, school, home, just whatever, and looking at all of their goals holistically. But when that is not possible, right? And you came up against this and you realized this, that there's just such a large demand. There's an outcry. There's a need, just the same way we do, where we do this podcast, to serve many other people beyond just those lives you're able to directly touch. You came in contact with somebody that then said, I want you to fund you to help create this rubric or this tool that then makes something that can be created to be more accessible to help other families. So you created something called the Thrive Guide, and they can go to thriveguide.com to access that. But I don't want to do disjustice to the story here. So I want you to tell us about one, any more about the origin backstory, but also again, what the Thrive Guide then does.
Sure. This is exciting. And you didn't do it justice. That was a terrific intro. You're right that the Thrive Guide, and by the way, it's at .co, thriveguide.co. It's an online platform, and which is almost diametrically opposed to, as you said, where I came from and what I've been doing for 25 years, which is working directly with parents in their homes, in schools, human one-on-one, and building rapport and all of that. But it's not possible to do that with all parents, obviously, in the demand. And there was a particular aspect of what I've been doing for years that I called the treatment map, that we realized, hey, we could digitize this. We could put this on a platform, this particular part of it, and serve thousands of parents, especially parents in remote areas or parents on a waiting list that don't have all the services they want, or lower income families who simply can't afford all of that. So this Thrive Guide was created out of that. And what is a Thrive Guide? What is a treatment map? So for years, I'm going to say a highly autism-specific and individualized psych ed assessment. You guys know what a psych ed report is, essentially, right? So you go in, it's not a diagnosis. You're not trying to diagnose if your child has autism or not, but to say, what is your child's developmental profile? Where are they in their language learning? Where are they in their behavior? Where are they in being able to read, write, and all of these different things? And so when you get a psych ed report, and it tells you sort of your baseline, you know, and some things you need.
So can I use that as an example?
Yeah.
Similar, maybe perhaps to the Vineland?
Yeah, the Vineland would be part of a psych ed report. So
it would be a part of it.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. You might do the Vineland. You might do a vision test. You might do another language test with a speech therapist to inputs into a psych ed report. Yeah, this is an assessment, basically.
Okay.
So, but the treatment map,
it's so comprehensive.
It's very comprehensive. Here's what I heard from parents like you, which is, Jonathan, we've had some assessments, we've had some tests, we know our child can't read or write or do this and that, but there's so many options out there. What do we choose? Do we do a play therapy program? Do we do ABA? Or I did ABA for a year and it's okay, and we did some stuff, but we think we need some more. And then should we be doing play dates? And there's a peer group and all of those choices. by the way, and we haven't even touched all the biomedical stuff. And should we be giving our child omega oil and going on a CFGF diet? And what about massage and Reiki? And should we, you know, do magnetic resonance therapy and all of those things? And as I've told you guys when we first met, that what I specialized in is being able to identify which therapies and which treatments and which resources will most help a child at that point in their development. And so treatment map is where I would come into a home and I'd look at all of these assessments and I'd say, ultimately, here's your next four things that you should do. And I want to give you just a quick example to make it really practical. I was working with a family. I just started working with them and I was just setting up a program and I got an email from the mom. It said, "Hey, Jonathan, have you heard of auditory integrative training? AIT, where my child would wear, for those of you who don't know, your child would wear headphones and then they would hear certain sound frequencies. And it would be for children typically who have hearing sensitivities, the kind of kids that cover their ears to vacuum cleaners or can't be in, you know, a school gym and that kind of stuff. And so the idea is it will desensitize that hypersensitivity. And it's used for other things too. But it's pretty expensive. Parents can pay, you know, up to $10,000 for sort of 10 sessions, 20 sessions. And she said, "Have you heard about this? Should we do this?" And I wrote back, and this is what I said. I said, "Hey, listen, I do know about AIT. I've seen AIT. I've read books on AIT. I've been in centers. I know about it. And I believe it can help kids with a very certain profile. Your son, from everything I know, however, has had chronic ear infections and has been on a whole number of antibiotics and currently still has some infection. And you told me about that. And so here's what I want to suggest. I don't think it makes sense in terms of order and timing for you to go spend $10,000 on AIT when your child's ears canals are likely inflamed and still infected." And I know this sounds really logical, but no one had spelled this out for her before, because this is a mom like moms, like you guys, who are trying to do everything that you can for your child, often all at once, as much as you can and can afford and do. And I said, "Listen, let's slow this down for a minute and do it in order. I want to recommend that you take your resources, the time that you have in the day, the money that you have in your bank account, the energy that you have, and put it entirely into trying to reduce the inflammation in your child's ears. Let's try and heal that. Let's go for that beyond just the next course of antibiotics. Let's really dive in a little bit. And why is it recurring? That's not normal or natural that your kid would constantly have earaches. So there's something going on." "Yeah, but my doctor has seen that." "I know, but we could go deeper." So I said, "Do that first. And then once that's resolved, let's find what the baseline is then of your child's sensitivity to hearing at that point. It's going to be a different baseline if we heal the ears in terms of the infections, right? And the inflammation. Then let's determine if AIT, auditory integrative training, makes sense to invest in." And so here's what happened. What happened is she followed my advice and we went down pretty deep into helping the body and the ears get better. And the sensitivity covering his ears and other things went way, way down. That's in this case. I'm not saying that's true for all cases at all, but for this particular case, that happened for this child. And therefore, AIT was no longer an option that we should consider. And so we saved them $10,000 and we saved the child from having to go to all these therapies and go down that road. So that's treatment mapping. It's really deciding what makes sense now and what order and timing. Okay. So I tell you that as a background. What we've done in the last 2 years as we created a platform, Thrive Guide, where a parent comes in and there's a 1 hour intake. It's pretty in-depth and you answer all sorts of questions about your child. And it's an intake like you haven't had before. There are some questions that you've answered, like how old is your child, date of birth. But then we go into things like, and I'll give you a quick example, a little sneak peek. We might ask, do you have a lot of hard surfaces in your house? Or is your house mostly carpeted with curtains? Or is it more modern with wood floors and marble surfaces? Why would we ask that? We're trying to determine the echo level environment that your child's in. So if you've told us that your child has hearing sensitivities, we then ask about the environment that he's in. Why? Because we're going to make recommendations on how to make that environment more tolerable for your child. Just as a quick example. Now, it's a reflexive question set. So that means depending on how you answer one question, you may be given a different question. So it's kind of like a conversation rather than it's not a set group of questions. It's reflexive. Here's what happens.
So it's kind of like when you get an eye exam.
Yes. Depending on what you do.
And they flip the lens, and but depending on what your previous response is, correct, dictates what other set of lenses they're going to test.
That's right. It moves forward depending on your how you react. Exactly. So mm-hmm. after this cool intake, and by the way, I'll just pause and say we've had a number of parents write to us and say, hey, by the way, just your intake, which is kind of crazy. They're actually saying, we enjoy doing your intake. Like, how many parents like an intake? Have you ever gone to a doctor's office and sat there and they give you the clipboard and you got to fill it out and you say, wow, that was really enjoyable? No, the answer is no. But a lot of parents have been telling us that by doing the 1 hour intake, that they get insights in their learning. They said, no one's ever asked me that before. And it made me really start to think about this and that and how that's connected. That's really cool. So we didn't anticipate that. So that's really neat. Then you literally press a button after your intake and you instantly get what we call your Thrive Guide recommendations. And you get 12 recommendations that are chosen out of over 100 possible ones, by the way. So you get 12 that are specific, individualized to your child. And we have another, this is the amazing thing about technology. We applied another layer of technology, which takes whichever 12 you get from the 100, and it puts them in order, which should be first, which should be second, which could be third, whichever 12 you get. So now they're in order as well of why you should do number one and two. And with that recommendation set, which is like when I told the mom, let's do heal the ears first, and then we'll see if you need this. So it's like that. Here's your 12, and this is what you focus on. And what we've, so that's a Thrive Guide. What we've added, which is, we think, a huge, massive bonus, is you can click on any of these recommendations and opens up into a number of things. One, we give you the scientific research that supports this recommendation. So there's a link to scientific research that you can get, just so that you know this is science-based and you can read that if that's something that's important to you. Secondly, there's activities that are listed so that you at home could begin to do these, or you could print them out and give them to a teacher, therapist, whatever. And then we also give you resources, other links that you can go and check out and learn more about this particular recommendation that might be, for example, build more rapport with your child. We talked about that, right? That might be a recommendation. And then we say, here's how you can begin to do that. So just to be clear, it's not another program. It's not supposed to be a home-based program that you do for years. That's not it. But it's for the parents who, number one, have done a lot of things, but what do I do next? What should I be focusing on? It really clarifies that. Number two, it's for parents who are on a waiting list for service and their child is literally sitting at home watching cartoons, not because they want that, but they don't know what to do. And so this empowers those parents. And number three, again, for parents who are in remote areas, who just don't have service, even if they can afford it, they don't have access to lots of stuff, the Thrive Guide is right on your laptop. And you can get recommendations from all of our years of research, all of our years of doing the programming. So that's what it is. It's quite remarkable. And there's nothing like it out there right now. So we think no. It's really mm-hmm. quite a great tool. Very
there's
interesting.
There's nothing like this formulaic approach. And I know we don't have time to totally discuss it today, but you did touch on it. And even your example essentially is kind of even looking at things from a biomedical mm-hmm. standpoint, you know, because that gets in the mix of consideration. And some parents get totally attached to just that idea, and that if you heal all those things biomedically, well, then you don't have to do anything
right.
else. Kind of like it's like they're one solvent, and it's not.
No.
That, and it's also not completely ruling out that that's not something you need to factor into your approach.
Exactly.
You don't know that, but however, what this does is sort that out in a
right.
pragmatic way,
right,
in a digestible way mm-hmm. for parents to then feasibly on their own possibly execute some things and take some action.
Steps. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
An effective action, not even just needless, wasteless efforts. And that's what you are also weeding out, saying, I don't want you to spend $10,000. You know, that's, I want you to be able to avoid that, not just because of the monetary investment, but it's also, it could be a total waste, and you also aren't attacking the problem. That's right. So
it, yeah, 100%. That is important. I'm glad you brought up the biomedical piece. And just quickly, just to be clear, what Thrive Guide is not, and I said it's not another program for you to decide between. And lots of parents will say, hey, listen, there's lots of stuff on YouTube. There's lots of, I have lots of ideas, lots of activities, but I'm going to come back to this. Yeah, but how do you know that that language activity that you just found on YouTube is the right one for your child right now in their development? That's the thing. There is no shortage of stuff to choose as when you're a parent with an autistic child. There's no shortage. You can spend 20 years trying to go through all the activities and all the videos and all the information. The question is, how would I know which one to do? And so you either play whack-a-mole, or there's trial and error, or you listen to someone that went ahead of you. I mean, there's lots of ways, you know, when you have professionals and people you trust, usually the people that you trust and professionals are in one domain. You have a great speech therapist, or you have a great teacher, or you have a good music therapist, or a good soccer coach, which is wonderful. But the soccer coach doesn't know about feeding. So then you go to the hospital and you talk with a feeding specialist, and they're great and they give you a tip, but they don't know that really what's going on is this other stuff around feeding, which is related to sports, which is related to bath time, which is related. So what the Thrive Guide does, and we built the algorithm, and I'll just let you in just so you can understand this very quickly around biomed. The Thrive Guide for now, because we're just launching the last year, covers four domains: language, social skills, self-help skills and independence, and ritualistic behavior, ritualized behavior, the repetition of ritualized behavior we talked about. So there's the four domains: language, social skills, self-help skills, and ritualized behavior. We evaluate and assess, again, it's not a diagnosis, but we're looking to say, how could you help your child in each of these domains, given your unique child's profile? We assess the environment. How does your environment affect your child's socializing? Do you have more than one child? Do you guys talk a lot at dinner or not? Is there a lot of TVs on in the house? So how does your environment affect socializing? How does your environment affect language learning? How does your environment, right? So environment crosses all four of those. Biomedical, we look at the biomedical. This is really cool. We look at the biomedical factors that impact socializing, the biomedical factors that affect your child's independent skills, the biomedical factors that impact your child's speech. And then we also look at cognition and behavioral development. So there's three ways that we assess each of the four domains. And by the way, just very quickly, if someone's wondering, well, what do you mean the biomedical approach to language? And we're not looking at biomedical as the panacea. It's not an answer to everything, not at all. But it should be something that we should assess always, at least just assess it. And I'll give you a quick example. Some of the questions in the language section that are biomedical relate to a child's posture. And I tell this story in my book, Challenging the Myths of Autism. I tell this story, and I'll just say it very, very quickly. We worked with a little girl who was diagnosed with autism, but also was in a wheelchair. She had some muscle control issues. And she was often sort of, I'm going to turn sideways for anyone that can see the video, but she's sort of a little bit slumped over and like this. And we were working with her on language. And a therapist who at the time was much smarter than me, he was my lead therapist. I learned so much from him. His name was Stephen, a wonderful, wonderful, smart, brilliant guy. And I was watching him interact with her. And as I was watching him, I learned some things. And I'm shortening this story. It's in the book. You can read it, longer story. But basically what we discovered, guys, is this little girl who'd had a lot of speech therapy, she didn't have so much problem articulating and knowing language. Her thing was, because of her posture and in the wheelchair, she wasn't breathing correctly. Breathing meaning when you speak for speech, we know you have to fill your diaphragm with air, and then that diaphragm is compressed, air is blown out through your vocal cords and sound comes out, right? You could have beautiful articulation with your tongue and your lips. You could have beautiful knowledge in your brain about what words I want to say. You could have great lung capacity. But if you're collapsed on your diaphragm and not breathing properly, you ain't going to make much sound. And so I remember the time we went in, we asked her just to sit up a little bit. We supported her and had her torso do this a little bit. And here's what we did. And this was the secret. We learned that she was actually out of sync, that for whatever reason, her brain wasn't saying, I want to speak, take a breath. And so we cued her not to speak, but to breathe. We said, okay, take a breath, breathe in. And we'd say, so what do you want for lunch? And out came some beautiful language. Take a breath. Do you want this or that? And out came some more beautiful language. So that's what we mean by an example of a physiological or biological connection to language. So we're just diagnosing this kind of stuff and trying, I shouldn't use the word diagnosis. We're trying to assess some of these things. And by the way, we don't have all the answers of, oh, so then do this. But we might say, hey, based on what you told us, we recommend you go and see the specialist and tell them this. Tell them to investigate this. So sometimes that's what you get in a Thrive Guide recommendation.
Prompting them their curiosity and directing them.
Curiosity, but we're giving them, based on what you told us, it sounds like this. This is what you should be going and looking at, not that.
First, I thought you were going to say that because it's also common and it's not talked about enough, is posterior tongue ties.
Right. That's another thing.
It's unidentified. And a lot of our kids that are non-speaking and nonverbal, and some of them, the specialists that I talk to, they can overcome it with muscle development, because a lot of typically developing human beings have them and that they're unidentified, but they overcome it because they have the capacity and to do so, but some of our kids don't. And
it's another great example of probably thousands of kids who have had thousands of hours of speech therapy or ABA around language, and that's what's really going on is the tongue tie.
Right. And you never know it. And you never know, because everyone's just so familiarized with the anterior, which is in the front with lips and the front. They're not paying attention back here and what indicators and what to look for. I know I didn't until someone was telling me that this is definitely a probability.
Well, why would you, Jean? You're not a language specialist, a biologist. We talked about this before. You got to be a doctor, mom.
So but something we're required like, to right? be now.
You should know all of this. So the Thrive Guide takes a lot of information. And again, it's just four domains. We're going to add more domains in the future. We're going to add, a school component, and et cetera, fine motor, gross motor. But again, taking all of that information and then an algorithm that is able to figure all of that out for you is.
I love that. Exciting. And one thing I wanted to say that was so on point, and what actually the Thrive Guide does do, is that why there is no shortage. And so, venture to say again, there's a saturation of information out there.
Totally.
It's hard to vet through that. Why that may exist. What happens is also accessibility, and that there's an accessibility issue to also some of those options that may be out there. This is increasing accessibility to families that may not have access.
Right.
And that love that. That's one of the things that was probably not just how effective it can be, because obviously that can speak for itself. The is increasing that accessibility to families that desperately need answers and don't know how to do it or how to go about it, because you are only one person. You can't serve all of these people. And so I just felt like when you contacted us, and where we've just now spent these two very robust episodes to then finally share this treasure, this piece, this like gem of something, because I started telling our last time my kids went to the pediatrician, I said, I have this new tool that you're going to be able to share with families, especially our families that don't have access, they're having struggles with Medicare and Medicaid and their health insurance, or if they don't have any of the above, like this is going to be a tool for them. And that my pediatrician's eyes were like all lit up and like, I want it because it is coming in the door.
Thank you for passing it on. And by the way, you can access for a full month the Thrive Ed Mini. You get that the recommendations, all the activities for less than $50. Where can you get something like that? Like a full assessment plus the recommendations and the activities and all of that. I mean, and we did that because we want to make it accessible. Exactly what you said. If you go to your pediatrician, if you talk with somebody, a teacher, and you tell them about it, know this. Remember I mentioned there's just over 100 recommendations possible. We committed because we believe in science. We believe in evidence-based approaches. And we believe in it's got to have some evidence and does no harm. So 100% all of the recommendations, and you would get 12 of them, have at least one, sometimes two, links to, and I said this earlier, peer-reviewed published research. Just so that you know, right? So if a pediatrician is like, well, I don't know about recommending that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's got to be, you know, proven. You could say, listen, there is, and I'm talking about like top level journal research articles, right? So if we recommend this, and I'll give you just one quick example. One of the recommendations that's possible, depending again on the profile, but one of the recommendations is possible is to have more quiet time with your child where you literally sit, turn off the TV, turn off the radio, and don't say much, just be a listener. This is for non-verbal to pre-verbal kids. And one of the recommendations is spend 15 to 20 minutes a day where you totally make the whole house silent, if possible. If other kids are speaking, that's okay. But turn off the radio, turn off the TV. Don't say a lot. Don't try and talk to your kid. Don't do a lot of commenting. And some people would say, well, why would I do that? Because my speech therapist said, when I play with my child, I should be narrating and saying, oh, you have the puzzle and you like the red one and this kind of stuff. And that's also true. But we went and looked at the research and we know that for nonverbal and preverbal kids, that quiet or silence time often stimulates and triggers for them to have space where they can do more babbling and language attempts. And that when you're always talking and narrating as a therapist or a teacher, as a parent, their listening center is processing language and trying to understand it and doing that and taking in that sensory input. And they're not trying to output and they're not trying to talk so much. And so we show the published peer-reviewed scientific evidence for why quiet time leads to language sometimes to babbling. And so that's just a great example, I think, of an interesting, insightful recommendation. A parent could instantly go, oh, I'm in the middle of Nebraska. I'm in the middle of wherever I am, and I don't have the service and I don't have that. I'm on a waiting list, but this is something I could do immediately. And we know, because we've done these recommendations, that they might start to hear some more babbling that starts to happen. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a positive step.
I just want to, you're just like a walking library. You're my favorite. You're my favorite kind of people. I have a very few amount, small handful of people that I consider that, where it's just sweet. Like, and thank I just want to like a Jonathan in my pocket. Yeah, just want to pull you out and be like, speak.
Oh my God.
Speak. Please tell me.
Would you feed me?
Give me an example. Yes, we will feed you. I will give you margaritas. We've already covered
margaritas and food.
Yeah, you will be very well taken care of. That's just, you've so much institutional wisdom, and it's not also being waved around of like, I'm the epitome and I'm the pinnacle of all information either. It's that you still remain curious.
100%.
You come from it from that angle. Like you are through and through, you are a researcher, period. Like that is, you are that true to statement. And that's because I will say what a lot of parents don't know to delineate to when they enter this world. When you become a child, parent to a child of disability, and they start getting pushed to this expert and that expert and medical professionals, what I learned was parents also weren't delineating between who's a medically practicing doctor, like in the clinic setting, or who's a researcher. Mm-hmm. And they sometimes were finding themselves kind of at a dead end with a researcher because they weren't really even ever in clinical setting. Mm-hmm. You've been in clinical settings mm-hmm. as well. Like you've been a foot soldier, feet on the ground. You keep yourself kind of knowledgeable and maintained in that way to kind of continue developing it. But not all researchers are. And so, but that doesn't mean that it's not a viable asset or a resource. It's just being able to identify the two and knowing that it is a prominent thing that happens. Sometimes parents will then get on an airplane, go several states, sometimes to a different country to go visit with this person. And then it's like, it's kind of a dead end. Like, okay, well, I got this information, but they're not really telling me how I'm going to apply it. Right. You actually also have a knack for telling people how they can implement it. Well,
because you've done it. And by the way, that's where the book came from, is I had been doing what we call clinical work, or basically playing with kids in a play-based program and doing education for years. And I'm talking, by the way, guys, I'm talking about spending 2 to 3 hour segments of time like an ABA specialist would do with your autistic child, and then having a 1 hour lunch break, and then doing another 3 hours with the child 5 days a week. So I did that for years and years and years and years. And what happened is I was also reading research and going to conferences. We talked about that, the DAN conferences, lots and lots of stuff, ABA conferences and things. And I was having this discrepancy between, well, wait a minute, this researcher, the scientist said this happens. But I was working with a child yesterday where that was different, and I couldn't rectify those things. And so I got back in the day, I got these little recipe cards. You know, the recipe cards that your mom would write recipes on, or your grandma? Yeah. So I got a pack of those. And anytime I had an example of a discrepancy, I would write it down. I don't know why, but I just started writing it because I was curious. I wanted to know, like, are my eyes seeing the right thing? Or is it these guys, or like, and what was that? And without judgment, I was just writing it down. And after 5 or 6 years of that, and I had this stack, I thought, now I know enough to know what's kind of myth and what's kind of a stereotype and what doesn't hold water. And I have evidence for it. And I felt so compelled. I said, there's these 7 myths that frankly irk me, that parents are still being told this, that drives me bonkers. And one was that if your child doesn't speak by the age of 5, it's going to be really tough after that. So there's this line in the sand of, you got to get your kid to talk by 5. And after 5, if they're not talking, it's going to be much harder. They may never even talk. I've had doctors say, oh, after 5, he's nonverbal. He's not, you know, then that's it. But the science doesn't hold up on that. But parents are told that all the time. I told you guys the story before. And so I ended up writing. That's right. Yeah. So I ended up writing a whole chapter on that myth of language, of the, what I call the 5-year window myth. But that's where it came from, is the clinical, the frontline working with kids and understanding kind of what works, what doesn't work, what's kind of reality, if you will. But you're right. Research is very important. It's important to have theories and research and advance our knowledge about humanity and the body and the mind and all of that. But at the end of the day, go to a family's house at dinner time. And then after dinner, sit and talk with mom and dad. That's all I'm saying. To all of my fellow practitioners, all of my BCBA peeps, all of my SOP peeps, all of my, with deep respect, and maybe many of you do that, but I'm just saying, if you haven't, if you're a clinician that hasn't done, if you're a pediatrician, if you're a psychiatrist medicating children, and you haven't gone to a parent with an autistic child's house lately, right? For dinner or after school or before bedtime, by the way, go do it. Go do it. Just go do it with their permission. Right? Don't show up at their door and do it. And then see and figure it out and find out. Right. And by the way, it's an eye opener and it's insightful, and you will forever be able to have real conversations with parents and help them in a totally different level.
That's very true. That's what the medical training program does, by the way. That's right. They're getting insight to what it is like to be a medical mom, medical parent.
Yeah.
And they're getting a window into it where they don't get to see that. They see a very small snapshot of what walks in that door and is there visiting with them for 15 to 30 minutes. And it's not enough to get to fully experience and conceptualize and consider what it is and how to actually advise parents moving forward. And I think they end up kind of getting misaligned about what the next steps can be because of that, because they're just kind of like formulaically looking at it from a very almost binary, maybe slightly two-dimensional at best point of view. And it's not really giving like a full widespread perception. And that's, so that is like such solid advice, I think, for practitioners, whether they are coming up in the field or they already are, like, I would love for that to become more of a thing, because yeah. I think that that will, it, when those opportunities happen, it's just eye-opening. They start considering things they weren't considering before. And then they can start to say, here's other gaps in their care that we need to mend that actually would be a better agent to get the outcome that we want. And because it is, their mission is to do no harm.
Yeah, 100%.
That's their medical promise, you know? So you had brought that up. So they can find you by the thriveguide.co. And I know better about that because my domain's a .co too. And I always have to say the .co is correct. I was having to redirect behavior. It's because it's a huge behavior change where people are like, why is it not .com? And I said, because somebody took it.
That's right. Yes.
So it is .co.
That's right. 100%.
It's .co. So I can totally relate there. Commiserate, if you will. And your book is Challenging the Myths of Autism, and that can be purchased anywhere books are sold.
Yeah, and I'll just footnote on that. Yeah, Amazon is where most people go. And when you go to Amazon and you go to my book page, it'll say out of stock right now. But that doesn't mean you can't still order it. It just means it's not sitting in a shelf in an Amazon warehouse, but you can get it quickly. So go ahead and still press order, and then they'll tell you, you'll still get it. So I just wanted to say that. I've been having people call saying, your book's out of stock, I can't get it. Yeah. Just click and purchase it. Yeah.
Good. And then are you...
By the way, it's an easy read and it's lots of stories. I just want to say, parents don't really have lots of time to read books. And who wants to read that? You got all the 10 books. This book is good. You guys have read some of it. You can tell me if you like it. I think it's... By the way, I have read it twice. This sounds silly. I wrote the book a while ago, but
this is what my book really looks like.
Oh my gosh, it's awesome. But it's a good book, right? Would you say? Like, I mean, it's interesting.
It's a very good book.
Easy to read too. Yes. I mean, I think it's easy. There's stories in it. And yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying, I read, this sounds silly. Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, the last time I read it twice since I wrote it to refresh. And I like, but the last time I read it, I finished the book. And you don't have to read it from front to end. And you guys know that, right? You can like take one chapter and just read the 30 pages. Mm-hmm. But I read it and I closed it and I went, that's a good book. Like, I like that book. I learned some stuff from reading the book. I like it. I think it's a good book.
I think, well, not only so it's not just about whether I like it or not. I think that had I had this when my kid got diagnosed, this would have changed the way I would have my mindset and my mentally injured. And not that I would change what I've actually done, right? And the way that I've advocated for my kid, because obviously I do think I can now look back and I can actually, what it also does is allow me to introspectively look at it and say, okay, you know what? I really did make good decisions based on that way of thinking.
Affirmed some things. Yeah.
Right. And it could affirm why things, when I did make one course or one change or, you know, on direction, why they ended up not working out. You know, I think it was affirming in a lot of ways. So I think you can read it from the different perspectives, whether you are just diagnosed, you've been on the journey for a while, you know, it doesn't matter where you are. It is definitely a good resource. Cause that's not even just weird. It's a good resource. It's a good resource. And I think you can go back. And even if you read the chapter in one day, you go back and reread it again another day, you're going to get a different takeaway from it.
Yeah, I agree.
Cause you're going to think about something.
Well, that's where I read it twice.
And so that's.
And like I say, I wrote it, but like I go back, you know what? That's a good point. I need to like, just keep in mind and remember. Right.
Right.
So yeah. Yeah.
And are you on social media at all? Or
I'm not, but Thrive Guide is. You can follow Thrive Guide at Instagram. There's some stuff there, so you can follow that. For those of you who are on the business end of it, I have a LinkedIn profile. You can you know, hit me up there, as they say. I'm not a big social media guy, and just in terms of time. If you go to thriveguide.co, there are some webinars you can sign up for that are free. There's one on tantruming and one on rapport building. To sign up, and they're on demand, so you can do them late at night or early in the morning. So that's kind of cool. So those are some resources. On our site, thriveguide.co, there are some blog posts I've written. On my site, jalderson.com, that's a .com, but as in J for Jonathan and Alderson, my last name, jalderson.com. Yeah, there's a bunch of articles. There's one on multi-treatment. And I think what we'll probably do, if it's okay with you guys, if you want, I will pass on maybe two articles if you guys want to post them, or I don't know how you do that, but I'm happy to.
Yeah, that can be something that can be placed in show notes.
Sure. Yeah. So one is on multi-treatment, just because mm-hmm. we've been talking about this idea of multi-treatment. So that's kind of mm-hmm. a neat one. And anyway, so we can talk about some other things around.
Yeah. No, thank you. This has been
perfect.
So here's what I'm also going to be the next call to action for you, as if you're open to it. Okay. Is I have a feeling, because this has already happened when we've done these like comprehensive topics or episodes where we've done part one and part two, there's been a call from the community saying, we have more questions and we want to hear more. Would you be open to considering, based on the feedback we get, to come back and hang out with us?
She asks on camera, no pressure.
That's right. Yeah. What's my answer? Yeah, 100%. Listen, I love talking with you guys, but you know, my mission is really to reach parents and to just, you know, help them. So if that could be helpful for your community, absolutely yes. And by the way, we didn't talk about consequences. So I'm just saying,
I thought we did.
Right. Well, we talked about,
I guess we talked about discipline and our approach to discipline.
We talked about receptivity.
We didn't talk about inclusion either.
We talked about receptivity. And when you have the receptivity, your child's compliance is going to go up. But there's a whole way to actually do consequences. So, you know, we try and avoid consequences by getting the compliance, obviously, but there are times you got to do a consequence. So how the heck do you do that? And we have a whole way, I teach a whole way of, we actually call it, consequences that inspire independence and responsibility. So in other words, there's a way that you can do a consequence with your child that helps them to become more and more independent and responsible. And it's a really nice way. So let's talk about that sometime.
I think you just already made yourself.
Episode 3.
I think you already made yourself a spot. Cozy little spot. Might as well. I already put that somewhere on my
consequences.
Calendar.
Consequences. Yeah.
Thank you so, so much. And I do think that this, what you just even said in closing, is a true mm-hmm. testament to the genuine and the sincerity around the intention of your work, which, like, should speak volumes to, you know, how substantive your work is, like, really,
thank you.
Truly.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
Thank you for doing that work.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that work.
My pleasure.
And where have you been our whole lives?
Yeah.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you're here now.
Maybe in your pocket.
We're going to keep you forever in my pocket. Just going to carry you around. I mean, you technically will be in my pocket because you'll be on my phone
on the
podcast episodes. And I'm like, podcast numbers here. This is what you need to, everyone needs to
Well, thank you for your questions, guys. And Shannon, really great, your comments and your daughter as well. And like I say, I always go away and I'm going to be thinking about our conversation and just little insights that I got and things that I learned that I pass on then to other parents. So that's the idea, I think, right? Is that we empower each other and we pass on the good stuff. So thank you guys for the opportunity.
Well, thank you so much. And don't forget, everyone, while you're listening, go leave reviews. That's how other families find us. Go follow us on our Instagram page at momstalkautism.com. It's just at Moms Talk Autism, but you can find us at momstalkautism.com. And you can also message us at hello@momstalkautism.com if you would like to inquire or send us any direct feedback regarding any this episode or future episodes. So thanks for being with us today, and we will talk again soon. Bye.
Bye, guys.